Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to this week's Classic Replay with me, Justin Brierley, going all the way back to early 2011 for today's show. Now, Richard Dawkins is one of the world's best-known atheists, but he's always refused to debate the world's best-known Christian apologist, William Lane Craig. However, in a twist of fate, Dawkins found himself on the same platform as Craig in November 2010. Dawkins was one on an atheist team and Craig on a theist team as they debated, does the universe have a purpose, at a Mexico TED-style event. So in this show, with extracts from the debate, Bill chatted to me about the circumstances of their encounter and why he believes Dawkins and the tactics of the atheist team changed during the course of the debate. Hope you enjoy revisiting this rather unusual spectacle that even involved a boxing ring. So thanks for tuning in. Don't forget you can find many more shows from the Unbelievable podcast archive at our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Hope you enjoy reliving today's programme. Let me begin, Bill, by saying thank you for joining me on the programme today, Bill. For me, a personal honour because I listen to you regularly, I read your material, and I know many other people in the area of Christian apologetics for whom you are one of the leading lights. Tell us a little bit about how this whole event sort of took place and why were you actually invited to, I think it's a sort of effectively a Mexican version of the TED talks in America, isn't it?
That's exactly right. They're attempting to imitate in Mexico the sort of TED conferences in the United States that feature prominent sociologists, scientists, economists, and so forth. And last year they had a debate at this conference in Puebla, which is the fourth largest city of Mexico, on the existence of God. And so that was tremendously successful and drew a lot of interest. So they wanted to have a debate again this year. And my participation in it owes itself to Michael Shermer. Michael Shermer was in the debate last year. And so the organizers asked him who could represent the theist side in a debate. And he said, well, why don't you get William Lane Craig? And so that was how they contacted me to participate in the debate.
It sounds like the chief organizer, Professor Andres Roma, is quite a character. He was the one who came up with the idea of putting a full-size boxing ring in on the stage that each speaker would deliver their piece from.
He's a very colorful fellow, although he's called Professor Roma, and he has a doctoral degree, I believe, from University of California, Berkeley. He's, in fact, a real promoter and wheeler-dealer in Mexico, quite the entrepreneur. He's got his finger in 100 pies and has organized these conferences, which he then serves as the host of, really a dynamic fellow. And it was his idea, as the venue for these debates, to go out and actually buy a regulation boxing ring, which he then set up on the stage, and in which he then placed a podium from which we each spoke. So each one of us had to literally climb over the ropes to get into the ring before we gave our speech. And prior to the debate, they had the theme from the movie Rocky playing loudly in the hall so that everyone's anticipation would be built up for this event. It was really the work of a promoter.
I was half expecting to hear a bell ring at the end of your time.
That's right. Yeah, that was the only thing you didn't do.
I mean, coming back to the actual organization of this, at the time you accepted, I don't think you were at all aware that Richard Dawkins would be involved, were you?
No, in fact, I was told that he would not be involved. Professor Wormer had said that they had wanted to get Richard Dawkins to be in on the debate, but that he couldn't come to the conference. And so it was going to be Matthew Ridley, who is a popularizer of science and an author, and then Michael Shermer, the editor of Skeptic magazine, and then Michio Kaku, the theoretical physicist and television personality, which I thought was a very substantial panel of opponents. And then for our side, it was going to be I and then my colleague from Talbot, Douglas Guyvet, a philosopher, and then a young rabbi whom they had selected from Los Angeles named David Wolpe. So that was the panels, or those were the panels as I was given them.
But what happened then? Why suddenly, when you arrived in Mexico, did it transpire that Richard Dawkins was there?
Well, the Wednesday night prior to the conference, just the night before, there was a reception, a cocktail party, at Professor Wormer's beautiful home in Mexico City. And while we were standing about chatting, he remarked to me in a sort of offhand way, "Oh, by the way, Michio Kaku didn't want to participate in the debate. He doesn't have any strong views on this subject. And so we got Richard Dawkins instead." And you could have knocked me over with a feather. I just couldn't believe my ears that Dawkins and I would actually have a chance to be on the same panel, because for some time now he has just resolutely determined that he would not debate me, that he would not participate in an event with me. And now all of a sudden here I found myself on the panel with him, and as you can imagine, my mind then just began racing about how would I alter my speech to make it suitable for a confrontation with Dawkins. What would I need to say? How would my strategy be different? Many things going through my mind at that point.
Well, I mean, it's something that we've actually spoken of a couple of times on this show, the fact that up till now you haven't had a meeting, as it were. And in fact, I was at the Intelligence Squared debate about a year and a half ago, when the question was put, actually, funnily enough, by a listener to this program from the floor to Dawkins, "Will you debate William Lane Craig?" And he gave his standard answer, "I only debate archbishops or heads of states," or whatever his particular distinction is of what is a worthy debater. But
and besides, I'm busy.
Yes, absolutely. But can we assume that he wasn't aware that you were involved up until the point he kind of threw his hat into the ring?
I don't think we can assume that, but of course that was the question that I wondered about. When he was asked to be on the panel, did they even tell him that I was on the other side? And I thought, wouldn't it be funny if he didn't know when he agreed to be on this that in fact I was on the other panel? So I have no idea whether or not he was aware of it. I think it would be so ironic if it happened that he didn't.
How was he towards you when you met on a personal level?
Oh, it was a meeting to remember, Justin. I was standing in the room where the reception was being held, and I saw him come into the room and immediately recognized him. And I saw that he was going to move right past where I was standing. And I thought, well, I might as well grab the bull by the horns. And so when he got near to me, I stuck out my hand and said, "Hello, I'm Bill Craig," and introduced myself. And then I said, "I'm surprised to see that you're on the panel." And he said, "And why not?" And I said, "Well, you've always refused to debate me in the past." And all of a sudden, his demeanor just became icy cold. And he said, "I don't consider this to be a debate with you. The Mexicans asked me to participate, and I accepted." And then he turned away and, you know, looked off in the other direction. And I said, well, I hope we have a good discussion. And he said, I consider that highly unlikely, and walked off. And so that was my initial meeting with Richard Dawkins. It was something to remember. I immediately went upstairs to my room in the hotel and wrote this down because I thought, I don't want to forget the words of this exchange. And I wrote it down right away before I could forget.
And the way you tell it, Bill, I think obviously this, in a sense, the format of the event is not your ideal setting, I'm guessing. You obviously excel in those one-to-one strict debate formats. This was more of a panel, three on each panel, and everyone kind of coming up for 6 minutes at a time and then three-minute responses. I mean, how did you cope in that kind of an environment?
Well, it required a good deal of preparation, actually, Justin, because when you've only got a few minutes to make your point, you have to really economize on your words. And so I worked hard on my opening statement to be able to say what I wanted to say within such a brief compass of time. And I think that paid off. I think that our side did very well in a kind of tag team approach where one person laid out the case, the next built on it, and then the third one summarized and drew the threads of the argument together to come to a conclusion. So I thought that our side at least worked effectively as a team, which is so important when you have such brief speeches to give.
Well, let's hear some extracts from the opening statements of the debate from yourself and Dawkins. Let's start with Dawkins.
We humans are obsessed with purpose. It seems perfectly natural when we're presented with an object to say, what's it for? It starts in childhood. The psychologist Deborah Kellerman has investigated this very interestingly with children, offering them a question like, why do you think these rocks are pointy? Is it because of some geological explanation, geological cause, or is it so that animals could scratch on them when they get itchy? And below a certain age, I think it's about six, most children answer with the teleological answer with the purpose question. Yes, they're pointy so that animals can scratch on them when they get itchy. Children then mostly grow out of that purposive way of looking at the world, but not apparently everybody.
On atheism, there is no immortality beyond the grave. And what's the consequence of this? Well, as many atheist philosophers from Nietzsche to Russell to Sartre have recognized, it means that life itself is absurd. It means that life is without objective purpose. As Richard Dawkins has put it, there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but pitiless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being. Thus, if God does not exist, then life and the universe are without purpose. But if atheism fails to provide a purpose for life and the universe, what about biblical theism? According to the biblical worldview, God does exist and man's life does not end at the grave. The purpose of life is to be found in a personal relationship with a holy and loving God. As the Westminster Catechism asks, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. Biblical theism thus provides the two conditions necessary for an objectively purposeful life: God and immortality. And because of this, we can live consistently and purposefully within the framework of such a worldview. And thus, biblical theism succeeds precisely where atheism breaks down. Now, I'd be the first to say that none of this proves that God exists. But in today's debate, we've been asked to discuss not whether God exists, but whether the universe has a purpose. And the answer to that question is, it all depends. If God does not exist, then the universe has no purpose. If God does exist, then the universe has a purpose. On this question, there need be no dispute between the theist and the atheist. I think we can all agree with those two contentions.
Bill, the title of the debate was, Does the Universe Have a Purpose?
Mm-hmm.
You were quite keen
to make sure that from the outset people understood that whether the universe has a purpose is dependent on whether there is a God. Why were you so keen to make that point?
Well, I thought it was important to help the audience understand that the answer to this question depends upon how you answer an even more fundamental question. That is to say, you cannot answer the question, does the universe have a purpose, until you have first dealt with the question of, is there a God who has created the universe with some purpose in mind? And so that was why the contentions that I laid out in the debate for the affirmative side were in the form of conditionals. If God exists, then the universe has a purpose. If God does not exist, then the universe does not have a purpose. And so I wanted people to understand that the question couldn't be answered without answering this deeper question. The answer to the question, does the universe have a purpose, is it all depends. Namely, it depends upon whether or not their theism is true.
You are listening to Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians thinking. Special program today as we review the debate between William Lane Craig and Richard Dawkins. Well, they were at least two among the various contributors that took place in this debate called Does the Universe Have a Purpose in Mexico last year, at the end of last year, and we're hearing all about it today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, Bill. Well, one of the debaters on the atheist side, as I've mentioned, was Matt Ridley, another atheist scientist. He took issue with you on the way you set out the debate. Let's hear what he had to say.
I'm only hearing straw men. I'm hearing that there's wide agreement God, if the universe is not to have a purpose, then it must mean that God doesn't exist. But I think the universe doesn't have a purpose, not because I think God doesn't exist, but because I look at the universe and conclude that the universe doesn't have a purpose. It's nothing to do with whether God exists or not. We can go on to discuss that as well, but it's simply wrong to say that we've agreed that the universe will have a purpose if God exists. And I've also heard it said that it's not possible to live a fulfilling life without a freedom-bestowing God. Well, I think that's a terrible mistake. There are lots of us who live extremely fulfilling lives with a wonderfully purposeful experience, in which we do our own purposes, but that doesn't mean the universe has a purpose, and it doesn't mean that there's a freedom-bestowing God.
I mean, later on in the debate, Matt Ridley challenged you and said, actually, contended that you hadn't agreed on that particular set of contentions. He said, on the contrary, it's perfectly possible to live in a godless universe purposefully. Was he kind of actually picking up your point properly there?
Well, I think there was a shift in the negative side of the debate, which is very significant. That's one of the things you look for in a debate, is when a team has to shift from its original position and fall back on another position. And that occurred in this debate. Initially, the negative team was defending a no answer to that question. No, the universe does not have a purpose. But midway through, they shifted to this position that, well, we can create a purpose for our lives. And I think in so saying, they failed to distinguish between the universe actually having a purpose and our having the subjective illusion of purpose. Obviously, we on the affirmative thought that we can have the subjective illusion of purpose. I can make it the purpose of my life to hit 60 home runs in a single season in Major League Baseball, or I can make it the purpose of my life to be a doctor and alleviate suffering, or I can make it the purpose of my life to be a crack addict or a child pornographer. But none of these things is really the purpose of my life. These things are just invented subjective illusions of purpose, and that was really all that the atheist has to offer.
Okay, well, coming back to Dawkins, here he is again offering his reason for why humans mistakenly attribute design and purpose to life and how science has set us right.
Humans love to see purpose everywhere, and it's one of the great achievements of science, I think especially Darwin, but other scientists as well, to show that the impulse that we have to see purpose in anything doesn't work. And he did it Not with the easy things like mountains. I mean, essentially any fool could see that mountains don't have a purpose. He did it with living things. And living things, on the face of it, have purpose written all over them. We look at a bird's wing, an engineer looks at a bird's wing, an albatross wing, say, and sees that it's perfectly designed for the particular way of flying that albatrosses have. Swifts have a different way. You look at an eye, you look at a heart, you look at a kidney. Everything looks designed. The Reverend William Paley himself, who was one of the earliest, one of the most coherent, I should say, advocates of this point of view, elevated the living world as being the most important place where you can find evidence for, as he thought, a deity. Don't look at astronomy, he said, look at living things. But what Darwin did was to show that even the worst case, even the most difficult case, that's the living case, has a perfectly rational, simple explanation. You do not need to resort to the idea of a designer. That was an astonishing intellectual achievement. Something as complicated as an eye, something as complicated as a heart, even a brain. Who would have thought that by the laws of physics, unaided, unviolated, just filtered through this brilliant process of natural selection, evolution by natural selection, that the blind laws of physics could produce the illusion of design as complicated and as persuasive as we see in the living world?
Coming back to the question of the existence of God, I mean, from the outset, Dawkins gave what is obviously his classic argument, essentially, that yes, we believe we see purpose, we believe we see design, but it is illusion, and in fact it's perfectly explainable without some kind of teleological explanation. It is just the law of evolution, if you like, working itself out, but without any ultimate meaning, without any ultimate purpose or sort of destination in mind. I mean, you've obviously come across that 1,000 times before. Do you feel Dawkins, because he is Richard Dawkins, somehow has managed to, if you like, make this argument appear to be more than perhaps it actually is?
Well, I think that in the minds of a lot of untrained lay people, the argument appears to be persuasive. Dawkins spoke at the conference the day before the debate was held, and it was a hateful attack upon religious belief. It was insulting. It was vitriolic. I was really shocked. There was very little argument. It was mainly just insult and opprobrium. And yet, about 40% of the audience at this conference gave him a standing ovation for this talk. And it struck me that this man has had such tremendous influence, even in other countries, Spanish-speaking countries, whose language he doesn't even know, nevertheless have translations of his work, and he has followers that are avid fans of his in these other countries. So clearly his argument or his case is having a great, great impact culturally, I think, upon lay people.
I mean, it's interesting. You say that there was obviously a lot of a warm reception for him amongst the audience. Did you get the sense that the conference as a whole then was quite biased in favor of a sort of naturalistic, materialistic kind of worldview in terms of...
I think that was very clear from the speakers that were invited. They were overwhelmingly naturalistic, and I would say even scientistic. That is to say, they thought that science and science alone is the arbiter of truth, and that if something could not be answered scientifically, then as Dawkins put it in the debate, it's a silly question. So there was definitely an almost universal presupposition of naturalism and even scientism among the people that were speaking at the conference.
Well, it's somewhat significant that so many on that atheist panel are scientists in that sense, and many of the people invited to speak were scientists. In fact, the person that Richard replaced, as you say, is a physicist by background. Obviously, there's a sense in terms of the organisers and those taking part that science is the answer. And there's obviously an underlying assumption that therefore atheism and naturalism somehow goes hand in hand with it. I mean, how do you respond to that? Because it's almost it's almost inbred. You can't.
It's such a false dichotomy. This opposition is so constructed. What I think is the best antidote to this is for we who are Christians and theists to be enthusiastic and informed followers of current science. So in my work, if you'll notice the arguments I offer for theism, they don't butt up against mainstream science. Rather, I find myself squarely in the center of mainstream science with respect to issues in cosmology that I think are very supportive of the existence of a creator and designer of the universe. So we've got to destroy this false impression that has been fostered by people like Dawkins that somehow science and theology are at odds with each other.
Okay, so we've reached the end of the first part of today's program. I'm joined today by William Lane Craig here on Unbelievable, one of my favorite Christian apologists. He is known around the world for his defense of the Christian faith. He's an author, a philosopher. He's engaged in many debates with high-profile atheists and people of other worldviews. And we're looking today at the debate he had recently. He shared a stage, at least, with Richard Dawkins, among others, looking at whether the universe has a purpose. And coming up in the next section of the program, we'll find out why Dawkins accused Bill of an emotional argument, hear what Bill has to say in response to that, and why Bill feels the atheist bench didn't have a united front that day. All to come here on the programme that gets you thinking. Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, your host Justin Brierley. Wherever you are, however you're listening, I'm so glad you've tuned in. Perhaps you're listening on medium wave in the London area, perhaps via our DAB service around the country in the UK, perhaps online anywhere in the world, or listening to the podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Let me remind you that we have totally revamped the Unbelievable website for 2011. If you haven't visited it yet, do so. Loads of extra features, video interviews, apologetics resources. You can browse the show by topic now, so you can actually look for the types of debates you're interested in the vast archive of Unbelievable debate programs. And of course, there are a number of articles on there by my guest today, William Lane Craig, who is a noted philosopher, Christian theist, and apologist, and well, he's done many debates around the world with various high-profile atheists and people of other worldviews. Today, though, we're looking at the recent debate he had in Mexico with none other than Richard Dawkins, the arch-atheist, and it was a bit of a surprise to Bill that he was going to be sharing that platform, as we heard in the first part. He wasn't originally scheduled to be on the bill, Richard Dawkins, that is. But he was, and so it was an ideal opportunity to put some of the arguments for the existence of God and why the universe does have a purpose in Bill's view to him. Well, Bill, before we come back to you again, let's just hear a couple more snippets from the debate. Firstly, this is Dawkins making an interesting claim about what kinds of questions we're allowed to ask, and then we'll hear your response in return.
My colleague Peter Atkins, whose works I recommend to you, I think that it's high time that a scientist won a Nobel Prize for Literature, and Peter Atkins would be my nominee for that. He was once invited to give a lecture in Windsor Castle, which, as you know, is one of the homes of the British monarch. And at the end of his lecture, Prince Philip said, "You scientists are awfully good at answering the how questions, but what about the why question?" And Peter Atkins said, "Sir, the why question is just a silly question."
I think the most reprehensible position represented in tonight's debate is Richard Dawkins' claim that why questions are just silly. These are the deepest existential questions that human beings can ask, and refuse to ask such why questions is to reduce human being to mere animals, which is, of course, exactly what Professor Dawkins believes. We're just animated chunks of matter in motion. Love, questions of meaning, and so forth, they're all ultimately just spin-offs of the blind bioevolutionary process. But if God exists, then clearly these are meaningful questions. These are vital questions for the nature of human existence and destiny. The tragedy would be that if God does exist and you miss his purpose for your life because you think these are silly questions and therefore don't need to think about them, would be the ultimate tragedy.
You challenged Dawkins during the debate. You said that Dawkins had said, as you said just a moment ago, that why questions are just silly. What is Dawkins' ultimate problem with why questions? Why do you think his mindset is so firmly located in only the things that science can tell us have any worth in terms of knowing?
It must be, again, the presupposition of this epistemology or theory of knowledge of scientism, that unless a question has a scientific answer, that is to say, an answer that is available through the deliverances of the natural sciences, the five senses, that then the question is meaningless and therefore silly to ask. What this is, Justin, I think, is a lingering hangover of the verificationism and positivism that dominated philosophy back in the 1930s and 40s. It has been universally given up among philosophers and theorists of knowledge. It's been recognized that this old verificationism is self-defeating and far too restrictive to be a plausible criterion of meaning. And yet among people like Dawkins and others who were educated, I think, in the positivist era, this sort of scientistic approach to knowledge still hangs on in their work and lingers, and as a result, still has not been exorcised from popular culture.
One of the things, I think it was David Wolpe, part of one of his presentations was talking about the fine-tuning of the universe, cosmological constants, etc., and using, if you like, yes, science to show that there it leaves a gaping question about why should these things be so? Why should the universe be so finely tuned and constrained as to produce conscious life?
Because remember, the question is not do you have a purpose, but does the universe have a purpose? Not only because this universe is balanced on a knife edge, there are all the cosmological constants, which if you changed even by a fraction, would plunge us into darkness forever. Not only because the universe is so finely tuned and finely designed, but because all of you, all of us, have inside of us this remarkable mechanism that is able to comprehend the mechanisms of the universe.
Dawkins later, in responding to that, said essentially, well, even if science doesn't give us the answer, it's ridiculous to turn to religion for those answers.
Our colleagues on the other side have probably mostly given up on the living world. That was their happy hunting ground. That was the best place for them to operate, as Paley recognized. So they've been forced back now into places like the origin of the cosmos, the origin of the universe. And they like to point to the origin of the universe and say, well, science can't explain the Big Bang, or science can't explain where the laws of physics come from. Physicists are working on that. That's what scientists do. They don't lie down and pathetically say, oh, we don't understand it, so God did it. Scientists actually work on the problem. They set to work, they roll up their sleeves, and they work on the problem. One day, physics will answer those deep questions. And even if it doesn't, even if physics doesn't answer those questions, what on earth makes you think that religion can? Thank you very much.
I mean, is that what you're doing, Bill, turning to religion in order to fill a gap that science just hasn't happened to explain for
us?
Well,
I don't think so, Justin, and I think that's an odd allegation to make. I look at this as a question of philosophy. I'm approaching these questions not from the standpoint of religion, but from a philosophical standpoint. And the argument would be here that when you look at the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life, there are three possible explanations for this. One would be physical necessity, that these constants and quantities must have the values that they do and couldn't have been otherwise. The second alternative would be, well, it's just an accident that they have the values they do. It's just pure chance that the universe is finely tuned for intelligent life. And then the third possible explanation would be design, that this is the result of a deliberate design and that therefore there is a kind of intelligence that has designed the universe. And as a philosopher, I want to look at those three alternatives and see which one provides the best explanation. And my argument would be that the best explanation is the design explanation. And that, as I say, is a philosophical conclusion and has nothing to do with turning to religion for the answer.
Absolutely, and I would agree with you, Bill. The problem is Dawkins just doesn't seem to grasp that, recognize that. He seems to be stuck in that mindset, which says, no, if it's not a scientific answer, it has no validity, as though you're somehow, immediately moving outside an area of knowledge which is valid, and therefore we simply shouldn't ask these questions if we don't have a scientific answer.
Yeah, so that's exactly what the old verificationists and positivists said. If a question cannot be answered through the five senses, then it is a meaningless question. You are just making sounds in the air, and therefore your sentences, your questions have literally no meaning, no cognitive value. And as I say, no philosopher would defend that point of view today. It's self-defeating. The verification principle itself would become meaningless on that grounds, because there's no way you can prove scientifically that you should only believe what can be scientifically proven. That's a philosophical criterion, not a scientific conclusion. So the whole position is self-defeating, but Professor Dawkins, like so many in the natural sciences, is very naive philosophically. I doubt that he's ever studied much philosophy. And so folks like this fall naively into these philosophical traps because they don't understand the deeper presuppositions of what they're doing.
You were very keen, and indeed the team, the theistic team, as it were, certainly gave a number of reasons for the rational belief in God.
The question then is, have the two sides presented arguments and evidence for or against the existence of God? Now, so far as I can see, all I've heard from the atheist side is the argument from evil, which I answered and has yet to be replied to. We heard an argument from evolutionary development, but that obviously doesn't prove that God is not the supervisor who created life through evolution. That doesn't in any way prove atheism. I haven't seen any other argument for atheism in tonight's debate. So while we can agree that if God does not exist, life has no purpose, we've not heard any good or compelling evidence for the antecedent of that conditional, that God does not exist. By contrast, I think we've heard 10 arguments that I list for the existence of God. The argument from why anything exists rather than nothing, the argument from the beginning of the universe, the argument from the fine-tuning of the universe for life, the argument from objective moral values, the argument from the possibility of God's existence, David Wolpe's argument from the comprehensibility of the universe, number 8, the argument from the law-like structure of the universe, number 9, Doug Guyvat's argument from the nature of existential choice, and finally, number 10, the very nature of human beings as capable of asking questions of purpose. All of these, I think, constitute a powerful cumulative case for thinking that there is a transcendent creator and designer of the universe.
There wasn't so much response to those particular arguments from the other side. The one argument that really came through right at the beginning was possibly Matt Ridley and the problem of suffering, which you dealt with in fairly short order. But they wanted mainly to say, and indeed Matt Ridley came back later to say, look, we're not debating whether God exists or not here. We're debating whether there's purpose in the universe, and that can be an independent question. So he seemed to want to not tie purpose to the existence of God. And was this when this shift happened towards, yes, we can have a type of purpose, we can have our own self-made purpose?
Yes, although that wouldn't deny the first contention that we defended, that if God does exist, then there is a purpose to the universe. So if they want to maintain that the universe has no purpose, they would have to disprove the existence of God. Now, he wants to offer the idea that we can have these subjective purposes in life, and we wouldn't disagree with that. Our question was not whether or not we can make up or pretend that our lives have purpose, but whether or not the universe really has a purpose. And I think that clearly making up purposes for our lives doesn't really give the universe a purpose, because we could have inconsistent answers. You could develop a philosophy of life according to which the universe has one purpose, and I develop a philosophy of life according to which the universe has a different purpose. And if we were to ask, well, who's right? The answer would obviously be neither one is right. The universe in and of itself remains purposeless on atheism, regardless of how we happen to regard it.
And I think Dawkins ultimately recognizes that. Of all of them, he seemed to be the one most keen to suggest that, yes, ultimately there is no, you know, it is a blind, pitiless, indifferent universe that we live in that sense.
Yes, that's right. They did not have a unified front on the atheist team, and so there was inconsistency there.
Okay, well, let's go to another of the points that Dawkins made during the debate. He made this assertion that the theist bench, particularly yourself and Rabbi David Wolpe, were essentially making an emotional argument for God and purpose in the universe.
I think the whole case the other side is putting really comes down to an emotional case rather than a rational one. William Lane Craig seemed to think that it would be so intolerable, so disagreeable, that we are doomed to death, that the universe is doomed to death, somehow playing on the heartstrings, playing on the emotions. It's not nice to think that we're all going to die. It's not nice to think that the universe is going to die a heat death and that everything is going to come to an end. It's not nice to think that everything is meaningless. And therefore, somehow, that must prove that there is purpose in the universe, that there is some sort of top-down supervising God. David Wolpe seemed to, I thought rather disagreeably, claim for the theist side a monopoly on such things as love and the things that, again, touch the heartstrings. Do the people on that side really think that atheists don't love? Do they really think that we don't get a fantastic swelling of the breast when we look up at the Milky Way, when we look down a microscope and see the amazing complexity?
What Dawkins wanted to put across from early on was that the argument for purpose in the universe was essentially an emotional argument, that we want there to be purpose, we want there to be, you know, some kind of ultimate.
Yes, he was responding to David Wolpe's point about sitting by the bedside of a dying person and being able to tell the person that that there is a purpose for his existence and so forth. And I think that David, in that sense, did open himself to Dawkins' response, well, this is just emotional. But what Dawkins had to do in that case then was ignore all of the other arguments for the existence of God, which I, David, and Doug had given. I counted 10 in number that we at least were able to list. So he was snatching at that one straw of emotion, but ignoring all of the other positive arguments that we had listed for a theistic view.
Yes, and you came back a little later on.
And that's why I agree with Richard Dawkins when he said, at bottom, this is an emotional question rather than a rational one. I wish I had had the courage to say that. I'm convinced that people adopt atheism, at least tonight, primarily for emotional rather than rational purposes. The rational arguments tonight all have supported theism. But you cannot live as though your life were purposeless and meaningless. And therefore, you adopt subjective illusions of purpose to make your life livable. And that's why I think atheism is not only irrational, it is profoundly unlivable. You cannot live consistently and purposefully within the context of an atheistic worldview.
Thank you.
You said atheism is in fact, in some ways, the emotional point of view, because...
Yeah. I actually agreed with him on that with respect to atheism, and I say this not as some sort of rhetorical ploy, but honestly, Justin, the more I talk with atheists, especially young students, the more I'm convinced that this is just an emotional reaction based on a kind of repugnance or anger with God or revulsion at the idea of God, and it's not well thought out or reasoned at all. It really is just motivated by emotions.
Near the end of your presentation, Bill, You said in response to Dawkins that atheism is not just irrational, but unlivable. Tell us a little bit about why you were taking that line.
Well, I think that was illustrated in the debate by the shift of ground that we saw in the negative team's position. It is existentially unbearable to live one's life as though it were objectively meaningless, valueless, and purposeless. That leads to despair, as existentialist philosophers recognized. And therefore, it really is impossible, I think, to live consistently and happily within the framework of an atheistic worldview. So, in order to live happily, what you do is you invent a purpose for your life. You make up a set of values that you want to hold onto, and you invest your life with meaning of your own concoction. But in moments of honesty, at the end of the day, you have to admit that this is really all just in your head, that the universe and life don't really have any meaning, value, or purpose on atheism. It's all just matter and motion, and it's all doomed to destruction in the heat death of the universe. And nothing you do or think or say will ultimately make any difference whatsoever. So I think that the naturalistic philosophy is really just existentially unlivable, and the negative team in this debate, I think, illustrated that fact by their shift to the affirmation of these subjective meanings.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable with my guest, William Lane Craig, joining me by phone from the United States of America, where he lives, where he teaches, where he is a philosopher, theologian, a defender of the Christian faith. He has written many books, and I'm going to be putting a link up, of course, to his website with this podcast of the program. Do check it out, the Unbelievable webpage, where you can find the podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Okay, well, let's hear another couple of clips from the debate. This is Dawkins claiming that your side, Bill, were making out that atheists are essentially denied any purposeful experiences. And then we'll hear some of your responses to it.
The other side uses words like mere, accident, reductive, nothing but chemistry, nothing but blind forces. What our side is saying is that because of the amazing process of evolution by natural selection, we have brains that bring into the universe, maybe for the first time, that bring into the universe all these wonderful things like love and value and indeed purpose. We construct our own purposes. Do you seriously think that the people on our side don't have purposes? Do you think that we don't fall in love? Do you think that we don't, when we write our books, have a purpose in writing our books? Do you think that when we go through life, we lack all purpose simply because there is no top-down governor? We have purposes just the same as anybody else. But we have an explanation for why we have a brain that has a purpose. It's because of evolution by natural selection.
We've argued tonight, first of all, that if God does not exist, then the universe has no purpose. Our atheist colleagues admit that. But now what they've been claiming is, but look, we can construct a purpose for our lives, in Richard Dawkins' words, or in Michael Shermer's words, we can develop ways to make us feel better, feeling like we have a purpose. Now, you see, this just is to say that we can pretend that the universe exists for some purpose. And this is just make-believe. This is the subjective illusion of purpose. But there is, on this view, no objective purpose for the universe. And we, of course, would never deny that you can't develop subjective purposes for your life. The point is, on atheism, they're all illusory.
Well, there you are. So Dawkins wasn't denying that the values he believes in are the result of evolved brains that bring about feelings of love and value and construct purpose.
Sure.
But he still kind of... there's. I suppose your point, Bill, is that... But we don't live as though these are just the construct of a highly complicated neurophysical system. We live as though these are things have eternal value, as though there are absolute values that exist in the world, in the universe.
And that was where Michael Shermer, I think, was really making a lot of rhetorical plays in the debate saying, well, if God doesn't exist, wouldn't we still love our children? Wouldn't we still want to affirm the values that we do, and so forth? And that's not anything we disagreed with. Of course we would do that, but we would do so then without any adequate explanatory ground for the objectivity of those values and purposes that we hold dear. What we offer to them as theists is not a new set of values or a new set of meanings. What we offer them is a foundation for the affirmation of those values and meanings that we hold dear and hold in common.
So, at the end of the debate, Bill, was there any kind of vote taken? Was there any way of indicating whether the audience had changed its mind on the question?
No, there was no vote taken, and I think that's for the better, really, because we want each person to think about this himself. And really, the target audience here, at least for me, was not so much the couple of thousand people that were in the auditorium. It's the audience that will see this on Mexican television, in movie theaters, and especially then on the internet, on YouTube, where hundreds of thousands of people will be able to view this debate over the next few years.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the phenomenal things that YouTube, especially on the internet, has done, Bill. It's brought your work, your debates, to beyond just the lecture halls and theatres that you've spoken to a much, much wider audience. And it's interesting to see how many people are kind of seeing you as the person to respond to these days when it comes to the Christian point of view. Do you kind of sense that? Do you feel like you have a kind of very important role in a certain sphere of Christian ministry?
Well, I think it's growing. I still get the response from folks, why haven't we ever heard of you before? Or who's ever heard of William Lane Craig? But I do think that through YouTube and the internet, the impact of our ministry is increasing, and for that I'm extremely grateful. I find it ironic because I have never put a single video on YouTube in my life. All of these are pirated from someplace, and then people stick them up there, and they've attracted tremendous attention, for which I'm very, very grateful, but it's wholly of other people's doing rather than my own.
Well, I'll actually be flagging up, funnily enough, one such video on the other side of a short break. A friend of Unbelievable, Peter Byram, has made a very interesting video mix of elements of the debate in Mexico, highlighting Dawkins' inconsistencies in some aspects of the debate. So tune in for that in just a moment's time, and we'll be getting Bill's final thoughts on the debate and what's coming up in the rest of 2011 for Bill. So do stay tuned to Unbelievable. Don't forget, we've got your feedback a little bit later on in the programme as well. We'll be back in just a moment's time. Well, finishing up our review now of the Mexico debate, this featured two people among benches of about six people altogether, but the two we've been focusing on today have been my guest on the phone, William Lane Craig, who is one of the foremost defenders of Christian faith in the world, and of course atheist Richard Dawkins. So Bill, thank you for joining me on the program today. What was your feeling though on how the debate went overall? Did you feel that you managed to get your points across? Did you feel that there was an overall sort of, you know, trying to look at it reasonably, unbiasedly, a winner to this particular argument?
We felt very good after the debate, Justin. When the debate immediately concluded, I turned to David Wolpe and Doug Guyvett to shake hands, and I think we were all surprised at how well we meshed together. David Wolpe shook my hand and he said, "We were really good," and we laughed because we didn't know how it was going to go, and it just turned out, I thought, extremely well.
Yeah, and I'd agree. I thought that you managed within the time frames you had to get the points across well and to respond to a great deal of what those others had said.
Good.
I suppose, Bill, you'd still like to meet Richard Dawkins, as it were, in a one-to-one encounter. Would that still be something?
Oh, very much. In any sort of format, I would very much enjoy having a go at it with him and talking about these issues pertinent to the existence of God. He's offered a lengthy critique of theism in his book, The God Delusion. I have responded to those arguments in published work. I'm convinced that they're worthless, and I would very much like to have a public discussion with him about these issues.
Is there anywhere else to go after him, though, Bill? That's my question. You've done just about everyone now. You know, Christopher Hitchens, you've done Dennett, you've done all of them, really.
With the debate with Sam Harris coming up in April at the University of Notre Dame, I will have publicly debated or dialogued with all of the four horsemen of the new atheism. So that's very gratifying. One person I think I'd like to do something with would be Leonard Mlodinow, who is Stephen Hawking's co-author of The Grand Design. I don't think Professor Hawking himself could participate in this sort of dialogue, but I'd certainly like to do something with his co-author, Leonard Mlodinow.
Well, that would be a fascinating interaction as well, and who knows what the future may bring. In the meantime, Bill, thank you so much for joining me on the program today. All power and all blessing to your ministry, and we look forward to hearing more about what you're doing in the coming year in 2011. Obviously, there's so many books and resources that you've written. I don't know whether, in terms of the debate you had on this particular occasion, there's one resource you would point people towards. I'm thinking particularly perhaps of God is Good, God is Great, those kinds of books that might help people to engage in this kind of issues.
Well, pertinent to the topic of the debate that we had, does the universe have a purpose, I would recommend the chapter in my book, Reasonable Faith, on the absurdity of life without God. That essentially gives my argument for thinking that God is essential for life to have an objective meaning, value, and purpose.
Well, I'm very glad to say, Bill, that we have that chapter, thanks to you, on our website, the Unbelievable
Wonderful.
Webpage. So if you want to read that immediately, why not visit premier.org.uk/unbelievable? But once you've read it, go and buy the full book. It's really worth its weight. So thank you very much, Bill, for being with me on the programme today. And I look forward to meeting you perhaps in person at some point later on down the line. And all the very best for 2011.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this week's Classic Replay, my review of the Dawkins versus Craig event that took place in late 2010. Hope you enjoyed it again this time round. You can find links, of course, to many things, our newsletter, YouTube channel, Ways to Give, and the archive of past shows at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. See you next time.